May it please the court, counsel. The issue today that we need to resolve, we believe, in our view, is the meaning of the release that was signed by my clients after the incident in 2003 in which Mr. Hennigan caught on fire in the operating room at Christiana Hospital. Subsequently, lawsuits were filed. Eventually, a release was entered in that lawsuit, and my clients signed off on that release, my clients being the heirs of Mr. Hennigan, who died in a subsequent event, and his wife, who is the executor of his estate. It's our position that the plain language of that release applies only to events which occurred in or about December 18, 2003, as that is the language that's on the first page of the release, and it relates back to all of the other causes of action. We believe that by the plain language of the release, it does not apply to any subsequent negligence that occurred at a different time. We say, for example, had Mr. Hennigan not subsequently died in the event in 2005 before the first case was settled, arguably Mr. Hennigan could have settled the first case for his injuries from the fire and signed a very similar release to the one that he signed in this case, with the exception, of course, that it wouldn't have any reference to his death in 2005. The reason I make that point is the defendants and the court below pointed to this release and said that it unequivocally released all causes of action that my clients might have, including the 2005 event. However, it seems clear that had Mr. Hennigan signed this release himself, or at least it seems clear to plaintiffs that had he signed this release himself, releasing his claims for this fire, and then in 2005, arguably after the release is signed, he passed away at the BV Medical Center from negligence by cardiology consultants or one of its employees, that he still or his heirs still would have been able to bring all claims. The argument that's being made by defendant and the argument that seems to have been accepted by the court below is that the original release barred the negligence in 2005. The second part of our argument about the release is that in addition to the fact that it clearly relates only to the incidents in 2003, there is a separate clause whereby not only the plaintiffs but the defendants as well specifically carved out the right for plaintiffs to bring causes of action for any negligence or any medical malpractice which occurred at BB Hospital in February of 2005. And the part that we believe is extremely important is that this release refers to any care providers. We would submit that the plain meaning of any care providers would include Dr. Delbakish and cardiology consultants who gave care to Mr. Hennigan in 2005 at BB Hospital. We note that the court below, in interpreting this portion of the release, in our view, improperly added additional meaning to these words. The additional meaning that the court added was that any must mean any other care providers who were not previously named in this release. It's our position that this is an unwarranted addition to the language of the release and that the plain language doesn't require any additional interpretation. As the court's, of course, well aware by all of its decisions, the court here can review that action de novo. And in reviewing it de novo, of course, the standard is not what the parties may have subjectively thought at the time that they're entering into this release that rules, but what a reasonable person would have thought reading this particular language. We submit that a reasonable person reading the language in this release for cardiology consultants would note that it applies only to the incidents on or about December 18, 2003, and second, that it exempts out the causes of action for what happened at BB Hospital in February of 2005.
I'm going to ask you about the your argument that it relates only to the events on 2003. In Judge Young's opinion, he highlights or puts in italics the language which would appear to suggest that it releases from all past, present, and future claims of whatever nature. Wouldn't that cover everything in the future? I know it goes on to say, and particularly, but is that an example, or is that intended to narrow the scope of the release?
Your Honor, in our opinion, what that relates to is any causes of action in the future which resulted or developed from the medical care rendered to Charles Hennigan on or about December 18, 2003. So, arguably, had Mr. Hennigan been burned at the Christiana Hospital, survived, goes home, files a lawsuit, settles a case, and then sometime later develops additional complications from that original injury, that would clearly be banned by a release that talks about future incidents.
Is it your position that the death that obviously occurred later was totally unrelated to the care that resulted in the release in 2003?
It was unrelated, Your Honor, in that we do not believe that the care in 2003 was a proximate cause of the death in 2005.
Do your experts support that, or have they testified to the contrary?
Well, no experts ever testified, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, given an opinion to the contrary.
There were affidavits early on when the wrongful death action was added to the 2003 case, in which the experts said, I'll buy it, as your honors clearly know, at a preliminary stage, that it appeared that the injuries that Mr. Hennigan suffered at Christiana Hospital contributed to his death in 2005. Nobody ever said it was the only cause of the death. They said it was a contributing factor to the death. In fact, what happened is, as he was recovering from surgery, he had an allergic reaction and his throat swelled shut. The thought, I think, at the time was that his airways were compromised from the burns and the scarring, and perhaps his lungs were compromised, and that is why he died at Beebe. But upon further examination and further review of the records and talking with additional experts, it became pretty clear that the events at Beebe could have been reversed and that the injuries, if any, from the 2003 incident did not make it inevitable that he would die in 2005. In fact, there were many opportunities for the staff at Beebe or Dr. Delbakish to take intervention and prevent this death.
Right, so, Mr. Hampton,
yes.
One of the key issues in the case is the meaning of the statutory language, one action. That is the phrase in the statute, one action. Let's go back in time, counter historically, and assume that there were two actions filed in 2005. The first one on day one was against the original defendants with whom ultimately there was a settlement. And the second action, which let's assume was filed a day or so after, is against the Beebe defendants and cardiology consultants. Would that second action, would one of those actions be barred under the statute? If those facts are frozen in time.
If I understand the example, Your Honor, there's two separate lawsuits against
two separate wrongful death lawsuits against two separate sets of defendants, same plaintiffs.
I think, Your Honor, the what would have to happen at that point is the suits would have to be joined. Otherwise, potentially one of them could be barred by the other. If they were both filed, one's filed and the other's filed shortly thereafter. I mean, sometimes that happens when you can't get service on both defendants.
All right. So is it your answer is that one, you couldn't have two lawsuits, you could only have one, and if you wanted to sue everyone who might conceivably be liable for wrongful death, you would have to join them all in one action, one or the other of those actions?
I guess, Your Honor, I'm having trouble with the example simply because I know that the facts were so much different. If it's a completely different set of facts, it would be very difficult to...
The question is hypothetical.
I understand. Your Honor, I suppose technically they would not be barred simply because of the fact that, in our view, what the one cause of action is designed to prevent is
just
multiple
one
plaintiffs.
Action.
One action. Is designed to prevent is multiple plaintiffs ganging up on the same defendant for the same injury. As has been made clear, what you're suing for in a wrongful death is the one injury to the decedent who could have brought the claim himself had he lived. Of course, he hasn't lived, so somebody has to bring his one claim. But if he has one claim against defendant A and one claim against defendant B for his death, I'm not sure that the statute was particularly worried whether the defendants would be joined together versus more than one defendant against a single more than one plaintiff against a single defendant.
Well, you've now given two completely opposite answers to the same question. Which is your position? You know, would the second action be barred?
No, Your Honor,
or would it not be?
I don't believe it would be. I mean, the statute may be a little bit ambiguous on that, but I think the statute is very clear that the one action refers to plaintiffs not splitting their causes of action to bring it separately against a defendant. I mean, obviously, we could look at the examples.
Is there anything in the record to support that view of the that is your view of the of what the purpose of the statute is?
Judge Vaughn's opinion in the Hennigan versus Beebe case, Your Honor.
Is there anything to support his opinion?
I guess just his analysis of the statute, Your Honor. I've not been able to find any other cases which directly deal with this issue. Certainly not in Delaware.
How about the statutory history?
In a different matter, Your Honor, we had going through a lot of the statutory history of the wrongful death statute, and it just seems not to really be addressed in the statutory history that we could find. Yes. It seems to have been almost a given that it was that was what they were trying to prevent.
But to for us to agree with your position that the statute doesn't create a bar to
correct.
A second lawsuit, we would have to also agree with your characterization of the statutory purpose, which is that you can't have multiple plaintiffs asserting separate causes of action for wrongful death against the same defendant.
I think that logic is supported by...
But there's nothing in the... that purpose doesn't preclude the same plaintiff from asserting multiple causes of action against different defendants.
I don't believe that was the intent of the statute, Your Honor, and that's why we take that position. In statutory construction, of course, the court has said that they won't take a position about a statute which leads to illogical results. And I won't go through all the potential hypotheticals, but with...
Well, you would agree, would you not, that at least from a literal point of view, that the statute could be interpreted to mean you get one lawsuit. That is, a plaintiff gets one lawsuit for wrongful death, and that which means that all potential defendants have got to be joined.
Your Honor, I could understand that somebody would read it that way and take that position. I think that...
Would that be a reasonable interpretation,
even though
not the one that you argue for?
Well, don't want to call other people unreasonable necessarily, Your Honor, but I think it's unreasonable to the extent that it seems to be equating one action with one chance. And I don't see that it particularly says in the statute that you have one chance to bring an action. It says there shall be one action. And so it comes down to what is the action.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the difference, your distinction between a chance and an action.
Well, the
I'm
action,
talking about one action here.
The action is the plaintiffs in concert bringing one action against a defendant. And I say it doesn't say necessarily that you only have one chance to do that if you discover after you've sued somebody that you inadvertently sued the wrong person or that they really aren't the real culprit.
Can't you amend the complaint then?
Well, you might be able to, Your Honor, but there certainly would be cases in which you would not have the knowledge as to who the real defendant was. It might be somebody's mysterious stranger or somebody that you don't know about and you don't find out about them until maybe the eve of the statute running, and so then you want to bring your claim again. The problem that I see is if you file a wrongful death lawsuit early on and you discover that, you know, we got the wrong person, do you then have to keep your wrongful death lawsuit alive and open for the remainder of the 2 years in the hope that you'll find the right person and then be able to amend the lawsuit? That's the difficulty I see with that scenario. I also see a difficulty with multiple heirs, perhaps, one of them pro se filing a complaint.
Well, in that scenario, couldn't you amend the complaint for a John Doe and dismiss the improperly sued party and continue to urge the court to allow you to find this person so you can complete service?
I suppose you could do that, Your Honor, but my understanding of the John Doe practice is it's not favored in Delaware and it's not permitted to have a John Doe plaintiff that you later name. Maybe in that situation where you have the wrongful death statute, an exception would be made, but my reading of the John Doe practice is the court has not favored that, and therefore I would say that it probably wouldn't work. I mean, it's hard to tell.
There's no rule that you can cite that would prohibit
I know no rule that would prohibit it, Your Honor, other than that it's not favored that cases just languish on the docket forever, and the John Doe practice is not favored and Delaware is not permitted. That would be the only things that I would be aware of. And stepping back to the release a moment, and the reason I step back to that is that it seems clear that the trial judge threw the entire case out based on a release, because he also threw out the survival action. And the survival action wouldn't be thrown out because of the wrongful death statute. They're separate statutes, separate causes of action, and that language is not in the survival statute about the one cause. So
what is in the record here about what caused your client's death and what caused the suffering of Phoebe? There's reference to earlier expert evidence that it's all related to the 2003 event, and now you're suggesting that no, it's not. But what is that? What's in the record on that?
Your Honor, in my appendix, and I'm not sure which exhibit it is now, but there is an affidavit from the defense experts in this case acknowledging that it was an angioedema suffered at Beebe Hospital, which is a swelling of the throat caused by some type of reaction that caused the death. So I don't think that's disputed. I think that's admitted by the defendants in this case. It was an angioedema at BB that caused the death.
Well, but is that the full answer to the question? Because what caused the angioedema? I took it from something I read and from something you even said earlier that scarring from the original fire in the area of the throat may have contributed to it.
Well, Your Honor, it either came from an allergy to a medicine or to tape, or sometimes you never know why people get angioedema. He was on ACE inhibitors, and they're known to cause angioedema, and that's thought of as the most likely factor. It was a blood pressure medicine.
So the record really doesn't show what caused the angioedema, but it does show it was the angioedema that caused the death.
Well, it shows that most likely it came from the ACE inhibitors. Everybody seems to believe that's the most likely cause. I mean, it's a little hard sometimes to get an actual medical opinion.
Okay, and your position then is it's totally unrelated to anything that happened in 2003?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Okay. You want to save your minute?
I'd like to save it, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. From the defendant's standpoint, we are relying on the clear language in the wrongful death statute that only one action for wrongful death is permitted. The action that we're here about today is the third wrongful death action that was filed, the first, of course, against Christiana, the second against Beebe Hospital, and then the third now against Dr. Delbosch and Cardiology Consultants. I'd like to follow up on a question that was asked by I believe it was Chief Justice Steele, about what caused the what evidence is in the record of the cause of the death. And on page 17 of our appendix, There is the report by Mark Gertner, who is the surgeon, who is the expert in the initial case, and I think it's important to point out to the court that he mentions in his report that he's reviewed, in the last paragraph of his report, he mentions that he's reviewed the Beebe records as well. So this was not a case of somebody not having an expert in time to review the Beebe records. It wasn't, because he says clearly that he did. And he still comes to the conclusion after he reads the Beebe records that it is the Christiana fire and the complications from the Christiana fire that is the cause of the death. And it's very clear here that that's what he believes, as does their other expert, Dr. Lees. They both say that, and those opinions, those reports did not come out until May of 2005, which was 3 months after his death in February of 2005. So they had the opportunity, and in fact had their experts look at the 2005 records and still come to the conclusion that the cause of death was the Christiana fire and its complications.
But is there another expert who now disputes that?
Oh, there are. I mean, Your Honor, there are other experts who now say that it was the, and the negligence in this particular case is the fact that Dr. Del Bosch allegedly did not come to the bedside an additional time before Mr. Before the decedent's death, and that's the basis of the negligence that he didn't come. We've taken in this case, we've taken the deposition of a nurse who was taking care of Mr. Of the decedent, and she testified that she didn't, in her deposition, and I don't think it's part of this record, but she testified that Dr. Del Bosch, she didn't call Dr. Del Bosch, and according to her, he was doing okay, and Dr. Del Bosch didn't need to come. But that's the real crux of the malpractice that's alleged in right. this third case.
Well, the appellant's brief says, and I quote from page 6, experts for the defendants agree that Mr. Hennigan's death was caused by angioedema. And is that, I mean, clearly that's what it
says. That's what it says.
That, and is that correct?
Yeah, I think this is one that's really up in the air, and I think the experts have come to this conclusion by the process of exclusion rather than actually identifying it and saying, well, it looks like, you know, all angioedema is a swelling in the throat that closes off the airway. Whether that is due to an allergic reaction to something, whether that is due to scarring from something previously, I mean, that's really something that's difficult for anybody to say. And I mean, if you ask these experts, well, what do you think it is? Well, it's angioedema. But that's not the real cause. What's all the right. cause of the angioedema seems to be the crux of it.
Mr. Ferry, let's turn to the statute. You know, there's a dispute here as to the meaning of the statutory term one action. In that regard, I gather you wouldn't disagree with the proposition that that term is ambiguous. It has to be construed in order to, in light of the purpose of the statute. Correct? I mean, as a general proposition.
I would accept that as a general proposition.
All right. Your honorable opponent then proceeds from that premise and argues that the purpose of the statute is to prevent multiple plaintiffs from filing separate actions against the same defendant for wrongful death. If that were the only purpose, then I suppose it would follow that the filing of a second or even a third action against different defendants would not be barred by the statute. My question to you is there some other purpose or different purpose of the statute that would support the result that was reached by Judge Young here?
Well, I think that, first of all, it's not clear what the purpose of that language is. I do think, though, that it can be interpreted. I mean, it's very clear. It says one action. It's been construed by courts to prevent multiple plaintiffs, but I don't think that's the entire purpose. I think having one action for wrongful death is consistent with the purpose of most statutes, that because it deals with judicial economy, it deals with fairness to all parties, and having all defendants and all plaintiffs consolidated in the same lawsuit, as opposed to having a situation. We do it all the time in Superior Court, as you know. We have two accidents. It's not clear where the injuries come from, so they're consolidated, so that we don't have separate trials requiring more time.
Well, what if you had the jurisdictional issues with, say, a party in Maryland and a party in Delaware jointly responsible for the wrongful death? So you had to bring an action in each state. Would the statute preclude that?
You wouldn't, from a fairness standpoint, you wouldn't think that it would. Perhaps there is a forum, you know, perhaps at that point federal court would be the better way to go if jurisdiction can be obtained over all parties that way.
But suppose it can't. Suppose you've got to sue one of the defendants in a different state, separate lawsuit.
Well, I don't know. It seems from a point of view of fairness that it would be unfair not to permit, that to occur.
So I gather your view of the purpose of the statute would be that where it's jurisdictionally possible, all the plaintiffs and all the defendants should be joined in the same lawsuit.
I think so, Your Honor. I don't think that, you can always think of an exception. I don't think it would come up very often, but under the exception that you proposed, and if you the way you couched it, I would agree.
Is this issue of the meaning of the term one action critical to your position on this appeal? That is the operation of the statute as it was interpreted by Judge Young critical to an affirmance of his result? Or could the result be predicated on the language of the release without regard to the statute?
I think it can be predicated on the release. I know the issue with the release is whether or not the plaintiff sufficiently carved out an exception to sue the same defendant later on, but I think the release is pretty clear in the terms, in the sense that it released all claims. And then if we look at that specific language in the release, it talks about
all claims, past, present, and future, of any nature.
Right. That's what it says.
And Cardiology Consultants was also a defendant.
That's right. And Judge Young construed it by looking at the entire release and saying, look, that when you look at the entire release, the intention here is to release Cardiology Consultants and not to and the carve-out was for BB and people who weren't being released in this particular release. And this release also specifically states that it's releasing wrongful death claims signed by each of the parties with the advice of counsel. It was not anything, I mean, in their depositions, they were all asked by me whether or not they had counsel available, whether they could ask their counsel.
All right, so Cardiology Consultants was a defendant that was released. in the lawsuit.
That's correct.
In the first or second, I can't remember which. So the only party, current defendant, that wasn't released was the second doctor from Cardiology Consultants that provided care to Mr. Hennigan.
Dr. Del Bosch.
All right.
Yes. But so he was released as part of, he was an employee of Cardiology Consultants.
That's your position.
Yes.
The other side's position is he may have been an employee, but he was another care provider that was carved out of the release. So the lawsuit should stand at least as to him.
Well, I understand what the position, you know, what their position is. I think that it's clear that if Cardiology Consultants is released, that their agents are being released as well. I mean, they can only act through their agents. So my position would be that he was released as well.
Okay, so your position is that the judgment of the Superior Court could stand based on the release, irrespective of the statute.
I do.
But in order to get to that result, we would have to interpret or construe the release so far as it pertains to Cardiology Consultants very broadly to cover any and all employees.
Yes, and I'd point out to Your Honor also, if you take a look at the complaint filed against BB Hospital, which is in our appendix, you'll see that Dr. Del Bosch was named in that case as well, and that case was dismissed. Quite frankly, I'm not sure what plaintiffs were doing. With all due respect to local counsel, I don't know what outside counsel was doing when they filed that case against Beebe and Dr. Del Bosch and Dr. Katz and many other health care providers, and then after Judge Vaughn ruled in their favor and didn't dismiss the case, then they dismissed the case voluntarily against Dr. Del Bosch. And so I don't think that the court wants this type of litigation where three lawsuits are filed for wrongful death when it was easy enough, even if they did have an expert who could say that the BB care had a problem, that they could then just amend and bring in Dr. Del Bosch and Cardiology Consultants before they signed the releases and before they went through concluding their case. I mean, there was ample time to do that, and I think that's the way that the court would certainly prefer these cases to run from the standpoint of time, efficiency, and also fairness to the parties. That way everybody would be in there and able to have their experts and actually try to find the truth as to what really caused this man's death by having everybody together. I think that's been the preferred way to do it rather than have finger pointing in to other defendants in separate cases down the road. There is also one other thing I wanted to point out with regard to the release, and that is on that carve-out the carve-out section of the release, which I think is on page 18. Page 18 and 19 of our appendix, it goes on to talk about the concluding sentence there: unless and until BB Medical Center is determined to be a joint tortfeasor with the releasees. This is another unusual issue in the case from our standpoint, in that by dismissing the case against BB, they now have prevented anybody from becoming a joint tortfeasor with them, unless BB is now somehow brought back into this case.
I'm not sure how that relates to any of the issues before us.
Well, I think it's just part of the frustration in having all these different. I think it points out the problem in having all these different lawsuits and what it can create when it's easy enough to have them all in one action. Under the exception that you, and that's probably the only relevance that it has. And to go to what your jurisdictional exception was, that would seem to be, in my opinion, the only possible legitimate reason for having a separate lawsuit.
Well, it's not my exception.
No, I mean the exception that you posed. The exception that you posed.
The language of this release is unique for this case, or is it patterned after statutory language, or where did this come from?
I don't know, Your Honor. I was not involved in the Christiana case myself. Our firm was not involved. I don't know the historical origin of the release language. I would suspect that it came from plaintiff because it's not part of a typical release or even typical joint tort fees release. So I don't know the true history of where it came from, but I suspect it would have come from something proposed by the plaintiff to be incorporated into the release.
You're referring to the exception or the...
The carve-out exception, yes. So I don't, in summary, I don't think that this court needs to get to the release issue. I think it's based on what this court has, the construction language that this court has used in some relatively recent cases, including the Leatherbury case, which is cited, including the Harris case, which Judge Ridgely wrote the opinion in, and in Danbro, which Justice Holland wrote the opinion in. If the language is clear, then it's going to be enforced, and it'd be up to the legislature to make any changes that it felt would be appropriate.
I'm sorry, are you saying we don't need to get to the release issue, or we don't need to get to the statutory issue?
You don't need to get to the release issue. It can be decided solely on the statutory issue of one action.
Well, there's one complication with that I don't know that you would necessarily think about, but we have to, and that is if this is a case of first impression on how the wrongful death statute should be interpreted, even on a distinct set of facts, it would be our common practice to have all five of us sit to resolve that rather than three. And have speculation out in the bar about what might happen later if all five sat. That's the dilemma.
Okay.
So if we were to try to resolve it in the first instance solely on the basis of the wrongful death statute, I would have difficulty doing that on a panel of three. That's a problem.
I understand.
So I'm looking to whether or not the release is determinative of the outcome of this case, and not really whether the wrongful death statute is.
All right. My position is that the position of the defendants is that under either way of looking at it, that the case is over, and this case is barred by the release. The plaintiffs went through the case. They had their experts. They settled, and they signed releases. And all releases by all heirs specifically included a specific reference to the statute, wrongful death statute, in those releases. And therefore, I think that...
Let me ask you, just on a survivorship claim, let's assume that the treatment at BB involves something that arguably is completely unrelated to the fire, but would cause pain and would be a basis for a survivorship claim. Your position is this release also bars that?
Yes, because it speaks of all claims, and I don't think our court has permitted the splitting of survivor and wrongful death claims as a general principle, but I also think that this release is certainly broad enough in its wording to include, when it says all claims, that it would include survivor and wrongful death.
Thank you, Mr. Perry.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, at page A150 of the plaintiff's appendix, it is the defendant's expert disclosures, and in the last line on that page, they write, the most likely cause of Mr. Hennigan's angioedema was a sudden reaction to the ACE inhibitor he was taking. So I think that speaks pretty clearly for itself. I disagree with counsel. I think that the release issue has to be resolved by this court, if for no other reason than the there has to be some reason that the court dismissed the survival action, and the wrongful death statute doesn't give that reason. And there's a case in here involving DJA, the state fund, in which they were allowed to have separate causes of action for the wrongful death and the survival action. So I think they are different causes of action and could be split. It's our opinion that the defendants, cardiology consultants, who, by the way, were not defendants in the first action but were on the release because one of their employees was sued, they knew about this release. They could have put language in there that says it also bars the BB action. They chose not to do so. The court shouldn't insert language they chose not to use. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hampton. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Please rise.